Once again, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the final installment of our People of the Book Rivalry Series. Great Rivalry Series. Ben-Gurion versus Begin. Now, what started off as a great debate between me and Rabbi Goldberg, you'll notice that I have the podium alone. So there are two options here. Option number one is that when Rabbi Goldberg saw the pamphlet and he stared down the prospect of debating Philip Moskowitz, a.k.a. David Ben-Gurion, he decided to be a no-show because he knew it was a losing battle. Option number two was he's out of town and he told me a few days ago that I'm going solo tonight. So I'll let you choose whichever option you think is the correct one. I won't tip my hand, but I am saying that he is a little bit lucky because he did not want to debate me. So instead, what we're going to do tonight is we're going to have a debate between me and myself and I about Ben-Gurion and Begin. And hopefully we will learn something, we will and find it inspiring as well. Part of the challenge with this People of the Book, perhaps to the exclusion of the other great rivalries, is that I am in the minority in this room. And I'm in the minority in the following sense. No one has to give away their age. Okay? Who here ever heard Menachem Begin speak? Either live or on TV live. Okay, so that's the majority of the room. Who here was not alive when Menachem Begin was speaking? Right? So I'm in the minority here in the sense that it's kind of ironic that I'm the one who's presenting, considering that I was neither alive when Begin was alive, but by then he was already in hiding and wasn't really so much of a public figure. So I'm starting off with the premise that all of you know probably a lot more than I do about both David Ben-Gurion and Menachem Begin. So with that said, my goal tonight is not to try to one-up anyone because you all experienced it, but my goal tonight is really to present it in what I hope to be a very condensed fashion, a very clear fashion. So that even stories we may have heard about, we're going to talk about the Altalena, everyone knows about that, right? Even stories that we're familiar with, hopefully I'll present it within the context, a very organized context of Ben-Gurion versus Begin. And through the entire presentation, it really will take us through 30, 40 years of modern Israeli history and a lot of the real fundamental issues that this new fledgling country faced. Okay? That's our goal this evening, and hopefully we will prove successful. So I want to start with just a quick video. Why a quick video? Because you can't have Yom Ha'atzma'ut, you can't be alive today and not tear up when you watch this video. So almost as the backdrop against our entire discussion tonight, we'll watch this. It's just about 60-second video.
זוהי זכותו הטבעית של העם היהודי להיות ככל עם ועם עומד ברשות עצמו במדינתו הריבונית. לפיכך נתכנסנו, אנו חברי מועצת העם, נציגי היישוב העברי והתנועה הציונית, ביום קיום המנדט הבריטי על ארץ ישראל. תוכת זכותנו הטבעית וההיסטורית, על יסוד החלטת עצרת האומות המאוחדות, אנו מכריזים בזאת על הקמת מדינה יהודית בארץ ישראל, היא מדינת ישראל.
Okay, so when we talk about the founding of the State of Israel, I think it's important to really set the backdrop whenever we talk about great rivalries. And that is, at least from my perspective tonight, irrespective of my personal political leanings, there's no right and wrong here. I think, certainly in our circles, and I'm going to make a political statement now about our shul, But in our circles, especially a number of books that have been written recently, so, you know, prime ministers, you have Danny Gordis wrote a number of books. So in many ways, Menachem Begin has become the hero of the story for us, and David Ben-Gurion has become the villain in many regards because of the way he's been portrayed through a number of these books. This is, in my mind, and I'm working under the assumption that our discussion tonight is an absolute machlokes l'shem shemayim. By the way, figure that out. It took me a little while. It's an optical illusion, right? But it's a total machlokes l'shem shemayim. I am under the assumption tonight that there's no right, there's no wrong. I am working under the assumption that both Ben-Gurion and Begin were 100% l'shem shemayim in their efforts on behalf of the Jewish people. They came to it from dramatically different perspectives, largely based on their upbringing. And that will manifest itself in all of the discussions that we have tonight. But again, nothing I say tonight, and I'm going to try to present a balanced view, as well as any media outlet tries to present a balanced view, but I'm really going to try to present a balanced view about this whole dispute between Begin and Ben-Gurion. And what I want to do is really divide it into four parts. Part number one, I want to talk a little bit about the Jewish underground and the violent resistance against the British. Obviously, Ben-Gurion and Begin had dramatically different approaches to how to involve themselves, how to engage with the British authorities, what was appropriate forms of resistance and what were inappropriate forms of resistance. Number two, I want to talk about intra-Jewish violence and the consolidation of Jewish power. You know, we take for granted that we have something called the IDF, that we have one unified body that's there to protect the state of Israel, and we all know that it wasn't always that way. That prior to the founding of the state of Israel, there were numerous factions, and part of the struggle of the founding of the state of Israel was, what do you do with these diverse approaches and these diverse factions? Do you allow them each to exist, and do you just say we have a broad tent of what our IDF is going to look like, or do you say that no, we have to unify? And of course, that reached its climax. That reached its head during the story of the Altalena. And that was really the meta-narrative to the entire story that was taking place, was the discussion about the consolidation of Jewish power. And it was, in boiling it down, it really was a power struggle between Ben-Gurion and Begin in the role that Etzel, the soldiers that were based in Yerushalayim, should play in the new military that was being founded. Number three, we're going to talk about German reparations. And the last one, which speaks for itself, and the last one, we're going to talk about Israel and the superpowers. Of whom should we be afraid? What should our relate? Is it getting cut off? Theo told me it wouldn't be cut off. Right? So who should we be afraid of? What should our relationship be toward other governments, to America, to Great Britain, even after Great Britain left? Should we be beholden to them in certain respects? Should we not be beholden to them? That's too much. How are we doing there?
Good.
Better? Okay. So those are the four points we're going to talk about tonight. Let's start for a second about the resistance. The Jewish underground and the violent resistance against Britain. So you see here, and again, many of us are familiar with this, essentially the resistance was boiled down to three major groups. You had the Haganah, which was led by David Ben-Gurion, the Palmach, the Irgun, whatever terminology you want to use. You have Lehi, and you have Etzel. Etzel is what Begin was largely in charge of. And Lehi, we'll see in a second, was more of a, what we would call in terminology, more of a fundamentalist group. The Stern Gang, of course we know, was an outgrowth of Lehi. Love Lehi. So what do we have? We have the Haganah, which believed fundamentally that their role was to supplement the British protection. They did not believe that they were a standalone Jewish militia, and they believed that they should express restraint in response to Arab violence. Now, why do you express restraint in response to Arab violence if you're a military force? The answer is because you believe in the rule of law. In other words, you believe that Great Britain is in charge of Palestine at the time, and that your job is to help them. Your job isn't to fight their wars on their behalf. Next, you have Etzel. Etzel was founded by Jabotinsky. Their logo, if you notice on the previous page, was a clenched fist raised in defiance, which already clues you in onto where they stand politically. And they fundamentally believed that independence is won through armed struggle. And of course, all the stories that we know about Menachem Begin are many stories about that armed struggle. Okay, and we'll talk about a number of them tonight. And lastly, you have Lehi. Lehi will describe as a little bit more hardline. They saw Britain as a real, legitimate enemy, obviously in distinction to the Haganah and even Etzel. Lehi really believed that Britain was fundamentally their enemy. And again, the outgrowth of that was the Stern Gang. Many of the most atrocious attacks were performed by members of the Stern Gang. And again, we'll get a little bit more into this as we go along. The first story I want to tell tonight happens in November 1944, when two Eliyahus, that's what they were known by, you have their names there, Eliyahu Beit Zuri and Eliyahu Hakim, so they attack and they assassinate Walter Guinness, the first Baron Moyne, Lord Moyne, the British resident minister. As a result, the two Eliyahus are hanged in 1945. And the British saw this as their chance, as their opportunity to eradicate and to get rid of the Jewish underground once and for all. This was the straw that broke the camel's back. They were going to get rid of them once and for all. We'll get to that in a second. And so they launched, I don't know how to pronounce it properly, the Saison. Anyone have a better pronunciation for that? What was that? But it means hunting season. And basically, the British... went to try to hunt down all of the members of the Jewish underground. So if you want to uproot the Jewish underground, what are you going to do? Whose side? Who are you going to bring along to help you? You're going to bring along the Haganah to help you. And that's exactly what happens. David Ben-Gurion unleashes the Saison, and for 4 months, Haganah fighters go around and collect or rat out completely members of Lehi and members of Etzel. They confiscate their weapons, they sabotage their operations, and in many cases, they turn them over to the British authorities. Now, turning them over to the British authorities isn't like it is nowadays. I get put in jail nowadays, it's not a good thing, probably lose my job, would make for a fantastic drusha, I'll tell you that much, right? But it's not a life or death situation more often than not. Back then, if you were a member of the Jewish underground, and we know this because of, well, I'll get to that in a second, but because there was a bounty put out on Begin's head, and if you were caught and you were accused of murderous activities, you were put to death. And so for members of Lehi and members of Etzel, for people that were coming to Begin, and they were saying, you got to respond to this. We have to fight back against members of the Haganah. And here was the first time Menachem Begin writes the following quote in The Revolt, where he writes, we decided not to suspend nor to promise to suspend our struggle against the British rule. Yet at the same time, we declined to retaliate for the kidnappings and handing over of our men. We said there would be no civil war, but in fact, throughout the whole country, a one-sided civil war raged. Begin was furious, he was enraged that Ben-Gurion was participating and really colluding with the British authorities in this one-sided civil war against members of Etzel, members of Lehi. And for the first time, and we'll see he does it countless other times, Begin says, despite the fact that we should be enraged and we should fight back, we're not going to. Jews don't fight against Jews. We will not engage. We will not participate in this one-sided civil war that is taking place. Well, as it goes on, the Jews realize, and this was the slide, it was out of order, but the Jews realize that they need immigration reform. And what I mean by immigration reform is they needed to get Jews from Europe into Palestine. The British had issued a cap on them. They weren't allowing Jews in altogether. In all three groups, Lehi, Etzel, Haganah, they were all in agreement that even if they opposed each other in the form of resistance and how violent the resistance should be, they all agreed that they needed to promote immigration and they needed to figure out a way to get Jews from Europe into Israel and so into Palestine. And so what they created was something called the United Resistance Movement, which was the collection of all three of these groups. And they decided solely for the purposes of immigration that they were going to attack critical points and destroy British symbols of power. Now, the British responded to this with something called Black Sabbath. Who gets that? Rick, you get that. Not that Black Sabbath. That Black Sabbath. I thought that was funny. they responded with Black Sabbath, where over 2,700 men were arrested. 2,700 Jews were arrested in a very short period of time. And more importantly for our story, what else was collected on Black Sabbath? During the raids, when you right think about when they raided Osama bin Laden's compound, they didn't just take him. What did they take with him? They take documents, computers at the time, right? So here, when they raided everyone's houses, they took documents. Documents that told the story about the collusion between these three. Documents saying, talking about what points that they were going to attack, what their philosophy was, what their tactics were. And they decided to house these at one of the centers of British rule in Yerushalayim. Anyone want to guess where they housed these? The King David Hotel. And that's what precipitated the famous King David Hotel bombing, which was carried out, and this is a misnomer of history, it was carried out by the United Resistance Movement. It happens to be, there's the explosion of the hotel. Do that again. I was very proud of that. Okay? Oops. Right? So it was carried out by the resistance. It was carried out by all three groups. We know who took the fall for it. In many ways, Begin took the fall for it. Ben-Gurion tried to shield himself from fault. He tried to shield himself from responsibility. And Begin, and he writes in his memoirs, you could read about it in Danny Gordis's book. He has a whole paragraph there in his memoirs where he talks about that he accepted upon himself the fact that he would be the one to take the fall, and he recognized that he was fine with it. He was wanted anyways, he'd be more wanted afterwards, and that is exactly how it happened. So it's important to realize the backdrop to the King David Hotel bombing. The backdrop was this hunting season, essentially, that was carried out first by the Haganah, later by the British authorities, Black Sabbath, collecting of the documents and trying to basically destroy these documents before the British realized exactly what had happened. The other story I want to tell, specific to this notion of the Jewish resistance, is the story of Shlomo ben Yosef. Shlomo ben Yosef and two other Beitar members in the Arab uprising, or the Arab revolt of 36 to 39, so they killed an Arab, they were captured by the British, and they were sentenced to their death. And I want to show you the different responses published in the media between Ben-Gurion and Begin, which in my mind significantly capture really their difference of approach to the resistance. First you have, I realize that's very small now, first you have Ben-Gurion's response, where Ben-Gurion wrote, "I am not shocked that a Jew was hanged in Palestine. I am ashamed of the deed that led to the hanging." He's ashamed. Why is he ashamed? Because that's not how we do the resistance. We don't kill Arabs. We don't try to kick people out of the land. Contrast that with Begin's response, where Begin says, "Do not hand the captured soldiers. If you do hang, that should be hanged. Do not hang the captured soldiers. If you do, we shall answer gallows with gallows." And it's those two quotes side by side which really symbolize a difference of approaches. Begin, and many of us are familiar with this, was much more stubborn in his resistance. He believed you had to fight, most literally, an eye for an eye. And there are countless stories of where when the British took one of theirs, they went after and killed one of the British right back. Ben-Gurion felt that's not what we do. "I am ashamed that we should be participating in alley killing, that I should be ashamed that we should be trying to get people out of our land." And so the number one issue that really, in my mind, captures that rivalry between Begin and Ben-Gurion is their approach to the resistance. How forceful should the resistance be? Should it involve an armed resistance? To what extent should it involve an armed resistance? How do we relate to once the British capture our soldiers? Do we fight back an eye for an eye? Those are all under the broad category of the Jewish underground and the violent resistance. That's number one. Number two is to talk about intra-Jewish violence. Should a Jew be fighting against a Jew? Should a Jew ever fight against a Jew? And again, to create a little bit of a backdrop here, you have to realize two things. Number one, is that part of the ceasefire, how long was the War of Independence for? It was a couple of weeks before there was an imposed ceasefire. And part of that imposed ceasefire was an arms embargo. And it was a full arms embargo. And of course, as Nathan just alluded to, it wasn't really a ceasefire. It was a ceasefire name. And as we know from the Gaza War, ceasefire looks good in the news, but fighting still continues oftentimes. And that's exactly what happened. After the War of Independence, Israel knew that they still needed weapons. The problem is that part of the terms of the ceasefire was that they would not bring in any weapons. It was a full arms embargo. That was challenge number one. Challenge number two, and this is where you really have to appreciate where Ben-Gurion was coming from, because challenge number two is Ben-Gurion was trying to found a state. And he was trying to found one unified army. And we all know that the most toxic thing in an army is dissension. Okay, that's why basic training in the military, long before you even pick up a gun, what are you doing? You're shining your shoes, you're making your bed, you're making sure that your buttons and your belt buckle are lined. Who cares? The answer is because the army requires a certain level of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Discipline.
Okay? Discipline, and more than discipline, but a sense of unity. A unity to mission, a discipline toward that mission. And so Ben-Gurion recognized very early on, and he should really, his tactics we can argue with, but at least his understanding of the issue, you can appreciate that based on what we just learned, that there were very different philosophies on how to approach Great Britain. So when he's founding the State of Israel, he realizes that you can't have multiple armies under one headline. Just doesn't work. And so Ben-Gurion decides that he needs to bring everyone under one name, which we now know as the IDF. Okay? What do you do? So Ben-Gurion and Begin reach a compromise. And the compromise is as follows. Compromise is they're going to create one thing called the IDF, Tzahal. When was the IDF founded? May 31st. So it's 17 days after the founding of the State of Israel. And before I even get to this quote, I'm going to come back to it. I'm out of order. Hold on. Okay, this is the compromise. Number one is that Etzel would enlist in the IDF. Very important. They would cease to be a militia on their own. Number two, equally important, is that they would turn over their arms, their weapons, to the army. You can't have an army within an army. Number three is that there would be no special Etzel brigades in the IDF. Also important. In other words, not only would they be part of the IDF, but they wouldn't work and operate as their own segment of it anymore. And lastly, is that Etzel would cease operating as a distinct military unit in Israel. That was the compromise. Now, who won the compromise? Who thinks Ben-Gurion won the compromise? Sounds like Ben-Gurion won the compromise law. He definitely had the upper hand. Okay? There's only one problem with the compromise. And the compromise is the language that was used in the compromise. And I'm going to read to you five words of the compromise. The agreement said, within the State of Israel. Now, why is that ambiguous? What was not in the State of Israel at the time? Jerusalem was not in the State of Israel. Who was still in Jerusalem when it was not in the State of Israel? Many Jews. Many Jews being defended by members of which militia? Of Etzel at the time. And so the whole issue was spurred by this ambiguity of language. Who would defend the Jews in Jerusalem? There are no arms, because there's a full arms embargo. Any arms that they do have were turned over to Ben-Gurion. So how are the Etzel fighters going to be able to protect the Jews in Jerusalem? So let's go back for a second, just look at a few quotes. First, we have a quote from Menachem Begin describing the difficulty he had in turning his four officers over to what became the IDF. He said, it was not an easy matter to send our comrades to an army whose officers had hated the underground, persecuted it, besmirched it, kidnapped its members, and handed it over to the officers. Again, think about the Sesson. The men who were about to take command of our members had been systematically trained to hate them. Dem's fighting words, right? There wasn't a lot of love lost between the members of Etzel and the members of the Haganah. Ben-Gurion responds, There are not going to be two states. And there are not going to be two armies. And Mr. Begin will not do whatever he feels like. We must decide whether to hand over power to Begin or to tell him to cease his separatist activities. If he does not give in a very prophetic line, this was written long before the Atalena, but if he does not give in, we shall open fire. The entire future of the country is in the balance. For Ben-Gurion, this wasn't just another issue. This was a significant, fundamental issue for the health and status of the state of Israel. Would there be two armies, or would there be one army? This, of course, reaches its head. What about Yerushalayim? We spoke about that a little bit. So what was the compromise? The compromise was as follows. The compromise before we get to the compromise, let's get to Atalena. Sorry. I'm going the wrong direction. Okay. The Atalena was a ship that set sail from where? Where did it originate? It originated in France. What does Atalena mean? Who was that the pen name of? Pseudonym? What? Not Herzl. Jabotinsky. It was Jabotinsky's pseudonym as a journalist. Okay. Hillel Cook. Who do we know Hillel Cook by his more popular English name as, for those who came to that great rivalry? Peter Bergson. So Hillel Cook purchases a U.S. Navy ship, calls it the Atalena, and loads it on both with people and with weapons. And the Etzel fighters, Etzel's supporters, sympathy, people who are sympathetic to the Etzel cause, they send the ship off from France and only tell Begin afterwards. Now Begin realizes that this is toxic. Because when Ben-Gurion realizes, when Ben-Gurion hears that there is a ship heading for the shores of Tel Aviv, filled with both immigrants, but more importantly with weapons, in strict defiance of this new arms embargo that was just reached, so Ben-Gurion is going to be furious. Moreover, who's Ben-Gurion going to blame? He's going to blame Menachem Begin. And so Begin goes to Ben-Gurion, and he actually tells Ben-Gurion about it. And Ben-Gurion is now in a little bit of a pickle as to what exactly do you do with this ship. The ship comes to Israel. It settles on the shores away from the eyes of the UN observers at Kfar Vitkin, which is north of Tel Aviv. And the question is, what do you do with the munitions? What do you do with the arms that are on the ship? And here again, you have a dispute between Begin and Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion says that every single weapon on the ship is going to the IDF. Begin says, my dear friend, who we just compromised, I think this too should be a compromise. I'll make you the deal of a lifetime. 80% goes to the IDF, 20% goes to the Etzel fighters fighting in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem. Okay? It's unclear exactly how that reconciled itself. If you read, again, for example, the Danny Gordas book, at least the way he portrays it, is left as a gray area as to what exactly was going to happen and what was communicated to whom. And again, that was part of the problem. Another part of the problem was who was going to control the 20% to the Etzel. Was it the IDF was going to control the weapons on behalf of Etzel? Was it Etzel was going to control it? All of these things were somewhat ambiguous. The next day, Ben-Gurion issues Begin. Begin goes and boards the ship. And Ben-Gurion issues him an ultimatum. You have 10 minutes to get off the ship. Begin does not get off the ship. And it's unclear who shoots first. It's a machlokas, as we would say. But nonetheless, they shoot on the Atalena. Etzel has 6 dead, 18 wounded. The IDF has 2 dead and 6 wounded. Okay, and then it travels from north of Tel Aviv, ultimately coming to the port of Tel Aviv, now in full view of the public. Now, full view in the public is a disaster for Ben-Gurion because it means people are watching what's going on. And it's there, and again, I'm obviously, many of us are familiar with this story, but it's there where the order is issued to shoot at the Atalena. Hillel Dolesky, who was the soldier behind the cannon, was told, when he was told to fire, he said, "I didn't come to the land of Israel to fight against Jews." To which his commander responded, "An order is an order." How many shots did it take to actually hit the Altalena? It was the fourth shot. First three missed, the last one hit the Altalena, and Dolesky said afterwards, "If I could erase one day from my life, I would erase that day." Now Begin responds. Begin jumps off the ship. Again, it's also a dispute, but in his diary he says he swam to shore, and he claims that the entire time he was swimming to shore, Haganah fighters were shooting at him. He was very clear, in his mind at least, that this was an attempt to assassinate him. And again, you have to understand where Ben-Gurion comes from. That's why I shared that previous quote. For Ben-Gurion, this was the issue. You couldn't have a guy working on his own. You couldn't have an army within an army. He had to make a stand. He had to make a statement. Well, Begin, the next day, goes on the radio and says the following. Well, that day. He says, "We do not raise a hand against a brother, not even today. There must not be a civil war with the enemy at our gates. Ben-Gurion is an insane dictator. That fool. That idiot." Well, Ben-Gurion has a few choice words for him in response. He says, "For no country can tolerate the importation of even a small number of weapons by private citizens or organizations without the government's permission." And listen to this quote. I find the tone of it, the vitriol, so striking. He says, "The entire nation must eradicate the evil which exists among us." The evil being? Begin and Etzel. Right? This wasn't just like a peaceful dispute. This was a clash of philosophies that really burned at each member of it. Again, listen, to eradicate the evil that exists amongst us. But in Ben-Gurion's mind, that's exactly what it was. This was pure evil trying to create a militia within a militia. Oh, and he says in response, hold on, I just lost that. It's fine. He said in response to, sorry, I'm just going through them again. He says in response to this, after the whole episode was concluded, he says that Altalena, which he bombed, in which many people look back on history as a dark moment in Judaism, he said that should stand close to the temple if it's built. Why? Because it's so sacred. It's so holy. It was so important for the founding of Israel. It communicated such an important lesson and message to Begin and to the entire Jewish people. Well, Begin does not like that line. Begin responds and says, "We had not yet buried our dead when Ben-Gurion claimed that the cannon he had commanded the fire, oh, it was the cannon, commanded the fire to fire at the Altalena was a holy weapon, worthy of a place in our future temple." Oh, the shame of it. No wonder people of high moral stature and impeccable repute chastise him for mouthing such sacrilege, reminding him that no holy temple can ever arise so long as there are Jews with blood of the other Jews on their hands. So again, I think in part of being an impartial observer to these stories, it's very easy to judge. It's very easy to judge in hindsight and to say, and to at least appreciate Begin's accusation against Ben-Gurion that he's an idiot, that he's insane, that he's a dictator, whatever words that he used. On the other hand, you really have to put yourself in the shoes. You have to put yourself in the shoes of a new country. You had very different philosophies on how to embark upon resistance, what fighting should look like, what the philosophy should look like, arms, weaponry, munitions, and at least you can begin to understand what bothered Ben-Gurion so much. You also have to realize that the two of them didn't really know each other personally well. And what they knew about each other, because Begin was always on the underground, what they knew each other was a lot of the headlines that they heard about each other. And so Ben-Gurion didn't know Begin, he just knew what he heard about Begin. And he knew that he was this guy running off, killing people, leading a militia, doing things that he didn't approve of. And so whether you agree with his tactics or not, nonetheless, you hopefully appreciate a little bit. And this again, this machlokas l'shem shamayim, you begin to appreciate a little bit of where Ben-Gurion was coming from. Again, it's very sad. 6 dead, 18 wounded from Etzel, 2 dead and 6 wounded from the IDF. You can go online. They're really striking pictures from the bombing. And to this day, you can go to the beaches of Tel Aviv where you find a memorial about the Altalena. Now we come to number three. Reparations. So the backdrop to reparations was twofold. Number one is that Israel desperately needed money. Number two is that Israel was welcoming immigrants at a rate that is unparalleled in world history. I have the number here. Yes, from the founding of the State of Israel until 1951, Israel welcomed in, its population more than doubled. So in three short years, its population more than doubled. Begin left politics in 1951 after his political party won a whopping 6% of the vote. And that didn't last very long because in, I think it was 1951, 52, so Ben-Gurion announces that he is engaged in negotiations with the German government for reparations. And you see the headline from one of the Israeli newspapers, the Heirut headline, "How much will we get for a burned child?" Now this was about the Holocaust. And this was about whether you can adequately put a price on 6 million Jews. But it was about a lot more than that. It was about a philosophy on what the modern state of Israel should look like. Ben-Gurion said to Begin, "Menachem, this isn't just a historical issue. This is your moral obligation to your family, your obligation to your murdered mother." Nothing like Jewish guilt. Why was he so adamant? Because Ben-Gurion was a pragmatist. Ben-Gurion realized that the state of Israel needed money, and that the best way to earn stature in the international community was by building a vibrant, economically self-sufficient culture. And the way you do that is by getting a sudden influx of money and investing it. And so Ben-Gurion, everything was secondary to that. He was the pragmatist. He was looking forward. We got to build a strong state of Israel. Begin responds, and I know for some reason this didn't come out as good, so I'll read it. He said, and again, the famous stories where he leads a march outside of the Knesset, and he says, "The most shameful event that has ever occurred in the history of our people is about to take place this evening. At this bitter hour," don't forget, Begin was outside of the Knesset, he wasn't a member then. "At this bitter hour, we will recall our hallowed fathers, how our slaughtered mothers and our babies who were led by the millions to the slaughter at the hands of the Satan, who emerged from the very bottom of hell to annihilate the remnant of our people." In other words, you killed us once, and now you're going to try to kill us again. "Mr. Ben-Gurion has sent policemen here carrying grenades and tear gas made in Germany, the same gases that choked our fathers. He has jails and concentration camps." Nothing like speaking to fear, right? As we know, sometimes from elections can be successful. He said to Ben-Gurion, "When you fired your cannons at me, I gave the order no. Today, I will give the order yes. You will no longer be a Jewish government, and you will not have your moral legitimacy in Israel." Once again, these are not soft words. These are not what we would call disagreeing agreeably. This is what we would call disagreeing disagreeably. Okay? How does it ultimately conclude? So we know ultimately Israel does take reparations. Again, whether it vindicates and doesn't vindicate him, one could very easily make the argument that so much of Israel's economic success is a result of that influx of money at the beginning of the State of Israel. People debate that to the day. But I'm more interested in what we would call in learning terms the Nekudat HaMachloket. So what were they fundamentally arguing about? And they were fundamentally arguing about the following two images. For Begin, it was look backwards to move forward. For Begin, you couldn't just ignore the Holocaust. You had to use the Holocaust to influence and to inform how are you going to found the new state of Israel. And for Begin, the reason why he looks backwards to look forwards is because of his upbringing. Neither one of them were particularly religious. But Begin, what we would say, has much more of a Yiddish neshama. And the way we know, I'll give you one example of how we know that he has more of a Yiddish neshama. When Ben-Gurion founded the state of Israel, what word is noticeably absent from the Declaration of Independence? Jew, God, I mean, there are many things, right? But God. Was Ben-Gurion wearing a yarmulke on his head when he declared the state of Israel? No. What was the very first thing Begin does when he becomes elected prime minister? He goes to the Kotel and he puts a yarmulke on his head. Again, Begin wasn't religious, but he had that, he had the Jew in his kishkas. Okay? I'm not saying Ben-Gurion didn't. But the history, the historical connection of the Jews carried a significant amount of weight in Begin's philosophy. When you come to Ben-Gurion, I would characterize it by the following. Never look backward if you want to see what's in front of you. Right? For Ben-Gurion, at least, again, I'm obviously oversimplifying things, but when it comes to reparations, for Ben-Gurion, it was all about looking forward. Yes, you could dwell upon the past. Yes, you can linger in what happened in the Holocaust, but the most important thing, basically the pragmatist, we have an opportunity to get significant amount of money from Germany, we got to do it. What was the past is the past, but if we want to build a big and strong and economically vibrant and self-sufficient state of Israel, we got to take the money. Okay? Parenthetically, who was vindicated? I know this, I can't even see this. Oh gosh. I'll read this to you. It's a great quote, and I just realized I didn't bring the printout of the slides, but I will afterwards. This is German-Israeli relations for beginners. So on that side, it says what Israel says. Israel says, good morning, Germany. Figure number two, what Germany understands. Holocaust, 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 all your fault. Figure number three, what Israel really means. Give free summaries. Right, that's the, it's a comic, it appeared, I think, in a German newspaper originally. I found it online. But in many respects, that kind of captures, from a German perspective at least, how they now view reparations. I was in Germany. Oh boy, I'm going to date myself right now. I was in Germany 14 years ago. And I was sent as part of a group from Yeshiva University, a group of rabbinical students. We were paid for by the German government to come to Germany to see what modern Germany looks like and to kind of be ambassadors for their new relationship with Israel. I was very ambivalent, as you can imagine. Actually, a member of our group, his grandmother said, if you go, I'll never speak to you again. So it took a little coaxing, but he eventually came on our trip. And one of the very interesting things that we found on the trip was, yes, there's a pervasive sense of guilt throughout German culture, except for when we met with a group of 20-year-olds. And when we met with a group of 20-year-olds, random 20-year-olds, in Germany, they were asked the following question by the leader of our group. In 40 years, when you look back on the amount of money that you're giving into Israel, how are you going to view that? And he said one word back. He said, my English isn't good, but I know this one word. He said, resentment. Resentment. So, you know, we always look at reparations from the Jewish perspective, but it's important to realize, I think, just the full picture of that in Germany, it's also a complex issue. Not that I feel bad for them, don't get me wrong. But in Germany, it's also a complex issue. But the Nekudat HaMachlokes, what really fueled their dispute was these two images for me. Whether you look backwards to move forward, or whether you say, you know what, we got to push forward, you got to do what it takes. And again, I think that's largely based on Begin's traditional upbringing versus Ben-Gurion's upbringing. And lastly, is of whom should we be afraid? And I want to talk to you about what's known as the Soblin Affair. Dr. Robert Soblin, this was in 1962, but in 1961, Dr. Robert Soblin was a psychiatrist living in New York. He was born in Lithuania. He was a citizen of the United States. He was practicing psychiatry. And in 1961, he was arrested on charges of espionage, of spying on behalf of the Soviet Union. He was sent to prison. For whatever reason, he was let out on bail. And while he was out on bail, he runs away. He tries to escape. And where is he going to go? He's a Jew. He's going to try to go to Israel. And so he goes to Israel. First of all, no one likes my image. It's complicated. I thought that was cute, right? So he goes to Israel. Now, what makes this so complicated is the question of should Israel extradite him or not? Well, at the time, 1961, Israel did not have an extradition treaty with the United States. Americans want him back. Do you give him back or not give him back? Well, I think everyone agreed that you should give him back. The question was, who decides who to give him back? The Americans wanted him back immediately. The Israelis wanted the Israeli court system to decide whether he should be returned or not. And they had, I think it was somewhat 10 days to decide that. Now, those 10 days were really what the argument between Ben-Gurion and Begin is going to be about. Because Soblin comes to Israel, and then he's sent away. He's put on an El Al flight. Israel wants no part of him. He's taken by a U.S. Marshal. He gets on an El Al flight. The El Al flight has a stopover in London. And what does Soblin do in London? Stabs himself. Tries to kill himself. Tries to commit suicide. It's on all the papers. You can't read those, don't worry. But it's on all the papers. Okay, he tries to kill himself. And he's stuck in London. And the question is, what do you do to him? Do you return to Israel, as he was asking, under the 1950 law of return, which says that a Jew will always have a place in the homeland of Israel? Or do you say that no, the Americans want him, we got to give him back to him? And that's exactly the dispute between Begin and Ben-Gurion. For Begin, who did I start with here? Begin. For Begin, Jews are now sovereign, and no foreign power can dictate how we should behave. We're going to ultimately give him back, but you know who's going to decide to give him back? We are. And it's going to be our judicial system that's going to decide to give him back. And we're not going to be told by the Americans what to do and when to do it. We're going to be told we're going to do it on our own timeline. Ben-Gurion couldn't have disagreed more fundamentally. For Ben-Gurion, the opinions of diaspora culture are essential for Israeli society. Ben-Gurion was afraid that when American Jews heard that Israel was becoming a safe haven for criminals, they would give up their support of the state of Israel. And Ben-Gurion was afraid that this was not an issue to have a fight with the Americans over. Israel needed America more than America needed Israel at that point. And Ben-Gurion felt, what is the point of engaging in a fight over such a trivial matter? And ironically, in really a twist of perspectives, Begin called Ben-Gurion out for having a diaspora Jew mentality. It's counterintuitive. But Begin says to Ben-Gurion, you're acting like a diaspora Jew. A diaspora Jew that's fearful of foreign countries. That's afraid of what Gentile nations are going to think. Begin says in defiance, we don't have to be afraid anymore. We're a sovereign nation. We're going to do things on our own. And Ben-Gurion, once again, the pragmatist, says to himself, is this really the fight? Is this the hill we want to die on? Is this the hill that we want to ruin the relationship with America over? Now, you and I both know that this was the first of many. It wasn't the first. It was one of many arguments that continued to, not this very day, but certainly recently, of tension, of that complicated relationship. Where did I like that one? Right? It's complicated. The complicated relationship that exists between Israel and the nations of the world. On the one hand, Israel is a sovereign nation. On the other hand, Israel is still a very small nation. Israel still relies severely on trade, on economic involvement, on certainly military assistance from other nations. And so what we experience nowadays of that complicated relationship between Israel and America and Israel and Britain certainly existed back then. And again, that was really the fourth pillar of the dispute between Begin and Ben-Gurion, is how much should we kowtow to what the Americans think versus how much should we say, no, we are Jews, we are proud Jews, we have a state of Israel, and we should start acting like that. We should no longer act like diaspora Jews. We should now act as sovereign Jews in control of our own state. I'll conclude with the following quote, because many of the quotes up until this point were very acrimonious. There was a tremendous amount, you can't mistake it, of hatred between Ben-Gurion and Begin. As you saw, they disagreed fundamentally on some of the most core and fundamental issues facing the state of Israel. What do you do? How do you fight Britain? What is the IDF going to look like? How are you going to help the economy of Israel? Is it worth selling your soul to the devil for money? At least how some people perceived it. How are you going to relate to foreign powers? These are the core issues, many of which, by the way, still percolate underneath the surface today or over the surface today. But it was a very, very acrimonious relationship. So I want to share one last quote. This was from a letter written from David Ben-Gurion to Menachem Begin in 1969. 69, he was prime minister already, right? When did Begin get elected? 70. So it was right before him. So he wrote the following. Ben-Gurion's wife had an affinity for Begin. And Ben-Gurion could never understand it. That's the context of the letter here. I didn't quote that part. But he says, my wife's going to be happy by the letter that I'm writing. So he says, I opposed you both before and after the establishment of the state, sometimes aggressively. I remained an adamant opponent of certain of your positions and actions, and I have no regrets about it because I believe I was in the right. But on a personal level, I never felt ill will toward you. And the more I got to know you in these past years, the more I have come to respect you. So I just think that's a nice way to end, that lest we leave thinking that these two hated each other until their death. That's not the case. They developed at least a disagreeing agreeably type of approach to their relationship. And if you notice, I want to point out one thing which I think is very important for us. When does Ben-Gurion acknowledge the turning point in their relationship? The more I got to know you. Which I think is just a profound life lesson for all of us. It's very easy to fight with someone when you don't know them. It's very easy to spew hatred against someone if you don't really have a face behind it. But when there's a face sitting in front of you, when there's someone that you've gone to know and you see the human being behind it, so it's that relationship which can sometimes supersede the differences. And while the differences still exist, it's mitigated a little bit. I find that every day in my work, and with this will end, Rabbi Goldberg and I and the BRS rabbis, we go out of our way to develop relationships with people that are different than us, whether in different denominations of Judaism, whether people of different faith, whether people of different belief systems than our own. And the reason why we literally bend over backwards to do it is because we all share the same firm belief, which is that you're always going to have disagreements with people, but if you have a relationship with that person, the disagreements become much more palatable. They become much more agreeable. They become much more, the tone of the disagreements become much different. And so I thought it was a nice way to end, a lesson for us, that even these two great giants, and we should appreciate these two great giants, that Ben-Gurion was arguably the greatest leader our country ever had. We, in many ways, wouldn't have had a state of Israel the way we did without his leadership. Begin in many different ways. See, you missed my beginning, right? Begin in many ways, although he really was the prime minister for a relatively short period of time, in many ways put a stamp of influence on the Jewish state. And I specifically called it the Jewish state in reference to Begin because that's really what he infused the state of Israel with, really that palpable sense of a sense of Judaism and Jewish pride and Jewish history and traditionalism. But it's important to realize that even though while they disagreed vehemently throughout their lifetime, at the end of their life, as they got to know each other a little better, so their disagreements became a little bit more agreeable. So hopefully with this, we understand a little bit more of the appreciation for these two great giants and what went into, and the disagreements and the difficulties that went into the founding of the state of